From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Nearly 29 million Americans have already voted in the upcoming election, and turnout appears to be crushing records. But with just about 2 weeks to go now, Senate Democrats issued a report yesterday warning people there may not be a clear winner on election night. And those Democrats say that's okay. So what should we expect on November 3rd and in the days that follow? Lawrence Norden is the director of the Election Reform Program at the Brennan Center. Lawrence, welcome.
Thanks, Peter. Good to be here.
Yeah, and you know, it looks like Democrats are trying to get ahead of this so that people aren't surprised on election night if there is no clear winner. What do you think? I mean, are you prepared to go to bed on November 3rd without knowing who's going to be the president?
Yeah, it's quite possible we won't know who's president, and it's quite possible we won't know key Senate races on election night. And really, that has to do with the fact, of course, as everybody realizes, a lot more people are voting by mail. And in some states, that can mean delays in processing and reporting those votes.
Well, in fact, we've seen already pretty tremendous turnout in states across the country in early voting. Do you think that's going to make the count even more difficult?
It shouldn't. And again, the answer always is it depends. In some cases, actually, the count might come out more quickly because people are voting early and voting by mail. So, for instance, in a state like Florida, the results for early voting and mail voting may come out much more quickly than we would see for election night reporting. That's going to be very different in a state like Pennsylvania or Michigan, where they're not allowed to process mail ballots until essentially election day and to start counting them. And in those states, you've had the secretaries of state say that we may not get the full results, the full unofficial results, until the end of the week or maybe even later.
Let's stick with Florida for just a moment. This is a key battleground state in this country. And as you point out, they'll start counting some of the ballots ahead of time. So if we have a clear winner in Florida early in this election, do you think that'll provide some clarity on the rest of the race and might ease some of the pressure?
Yeah, I think that's quite possible. And I think there are other states like North Carolina and Arizona, where if it's not particularly close and those states can be called early, we may not have the results from Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, where they're probably going to be a little bit later. But we may have a lot of clarity about what the race looks like because those key states will give us a pretty clear sense of what the election looks like.
Hmm. In this report from Senate Democrats, they say that they're concerned that the president will declare victory early. And that's because in-person voters are likely to be counted first, and they're also likely to favor Republicans, whereas the mail-in ballots favor Democrats. You know, what effect do you think that scenario would have on the election if the president comes out early on election night and says, "I won"?
I think the key thing to remember is it's not up to the president to say whether he's won or lost. At the end of the day, it's going to be the chief election official or governor in each state that is certifying the election results. And I've actually been encouraged. The media has done a pretty good job of communicating to the public that results may take longer this year. And the public seems pretty aware of that. If you look at polling, a large majority of Americans understand that we might not have full election results on election night. So as long as the election officials themselves are clear about what's happening and transparent, even if we have a situation where the president declares victory or Vice President Biden declares victory, the election officials are very clear that there's still a lot of outstanding votes that need to be counted and nobody knows yet the results, I think we'll be okay.
Well, worst case scenario, many people are preparing for this to go to the Supreme Court, which will likely have a 6-3 conservative majority. If that happens, how long do you think it might be until we have a winner?
One point I want to make is the Supreme Court should not be deciding who's won or lost our elections. That's really an extraordinary circumstance that we saw in 2000, and I'm very hopeful we won't be seeing that this time around. So if we're in a situation where the courts are making the determination about when counting should start or stop, then, you know, that means we've had an exceptionally close contest. And if that's the case, it could be several weeks before we know who's won. But there's another factor that potentially, if it's a very close election, where results might be delayed a little bit more. We are seeing reports of people asking for their mail ballots and then showing up in person to vote. And in a number of states, when you do that, you're given a provisional ballot. You're not allowed to vote a regular ballot. And so, again, if it's very close and it comes down to counting those provisional ballots, that may mean that we're waiting a few extra days to process those provisional ballots before we can say who seems to have won or lost a particular state.
Because they have to make sure that you're not voting twice.
Yeah, that's the main reason.
That's Lawrence Norden, Director of the Election Reform Program at the Brennan Center. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
Well, last month, a Senate investigation dug into those claims that then Vice President Joe Biden steered Obama administration Ukraine policy to benefit Biden's son Hunter's business in Ukraine. In fact, all 10 witnesses in that Republican-led investigation testified that nothing of the sort occurred. But last week, the conservative Rupert Murdoch-owned tabloid, The New York Post, reported on Hunter Biden emails supplied by Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani, purporting to show that the Bidens had somehow worked together. Wouldn't the Republican lawmakers have found that? Most news organizations can't verify any of this. CNN chief media correspondent and host of Reliable Sources, Brian Stelter, has been looking. And Brian, today's New York Times reports that at least one New York Post reporter didn't want his byline on that story because the source of the laptop claiming to have emails was unreliable. You're reporting that U.S. authorities are investigating whether Russians are involved. Tell us more.
Right. There are questions about whether this is a Russian disinformation plot all about smearing the Bidens. And certainly this New York Post story is sketchy in many different ways. I have confirmed the New York Times reporting that there were some people at the New York Post that were uncomfortable with the story and did not want it to be published. But it was published last week. It has given fuel to Fox News and to President Trump to try to smear Hunter Biden and, of course, his father, Joe.
Well, and you've also written that one of those reporters, or at least somebody involved in the story at the Post, was recently a Sean Hannity colleague. What you see kind of an endless loop here. What do you think
That's
is going
right.
on here?
Yeah. This is the right-wing media machine at work, creating alternative narratives to try to help Trump in the closing days of the campaign. A tip from Steve Bannon and a hard drive dump from Rudy Giuliani leads a former producer for Hannity to write a cover story for Murdoch's New York Post, which then gets hyped on Murdoch's Fox News, which then leads into the president's Twitter feed. And then all of a sudden, the president's dramatizing the story at rallies and calling it the second biggest political scandal in our history. A lot of what I just said is not tethered to truth. And ultimately, it is all about one thing. Whataboutism. I hate this term, but this is exactly what's going on, Robin. Whataboutism. If you say, what about the president's family connections overseas? They'll say, Biden's corrupt. You know, no matter what you bring up, no matter what anybody brings up, the Trump campaign engages in whataboutism.
Well, and Trump this weekend called the Biden family a criminal enterprise.
Bingo.
Joe Biden has called the story a smear campaign. His campaign's initial statement read, we've reviewed his official schedules from the time that was mentioned in these purported emails, and there's no meetings, there's nothing that the New York Post ever alleged took place. And as to the charge that this may be Russian disinformation, today on Fox and Friends, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said the story did not rely on that. Let's listen.
I'm not aware of any Russian disinformation campaign that would involve these emails or this laptop. No defensive briefing, to my knowledge, has been given. And so all of this narrative that is out there that would suggest that it's not real, that's the disinformation. You know, Adam Schiff came on and said,
you know, it's kind of a who can say disinformation fast enough story. But what do you think the effect will be? I keep going back to Republican lawmakers who more than likely wanted to find this dirt on the Bidens, did not. And so that adds to the skepticism about this New York Post report. But does it matter?
Right.
Because this is what happened in 2016 with Hillary Clinton's emails.
Right. Instead of but her emails, it's but his emails. This is ultimately about politics, about an agenda. And I'm sure Trump will try to bring this up on stage at the debate on Thursday night. I think it helps to think about this less as journalism by the New York Post and more as a TV drama. They want you to keep tuning in and getting angry and thus voting for President Trump again. They drip, drip, drip new revelations, new details, claiming there's something new around every corner. But you know what? Hunter Biden's already admitted to poor judgment in the past. His father's already addressed these questions. So if there's nothing really new here, the bigger story is, why is it leaking out now? And why is the right-wing media machine trying to talk about emails in the final weeks of the campaign?
Yeah, well, and we've heard Republican strategists say they wish they wouldn't. You know, they wish they would focus on things like the difference in economic policy, for instance, perhaps between the two candidates. But the point is, do you think with the small amount of swing voters there are, this will certainly gin up President Trump's base, but do you think it will get further than that? And by the way, Brian, you know, we discussed even reporting on it because it amplifies it.
And that is a challenge for the press and for Twitter and Facebook in this era of disinformation. There are a lot of unknowns in this story. There was a GOP strategist quoted in the Times saying, yeah, our base loves this stuff about Hunter Biden and laptops and Giuliani, but they are already voting for Trump. I mean, that's the bottom line. A story like this, a made-up scandal like this, doesn't move votes. It only motivates voters. And right now, President Trump needs all the motivation he can get.
Brian Stelter, chief media correspondent at CNN, host of Reliable Sources. Thank you.
Thank you.
Remember this?
I hate to make the donuts. The donut. It isn't easy owning a Dunkin' Donuts.
I hate to make the donuts.
Because unlike most supermarkets, we make our donuts fresh day and night.
The guys who make supermarket donuts are still in bed.
Fred the Baker, overnight Dunkin' Donut maker, starring in a 17-year ad campaign to fend off competitors in what was then a growing world of franchising, in which companies licensed their product and business models. But time to make the donuts also became a slogan for going to work and pole vaulted Dunkin' into the franchise stratosphere, from which they also sometimes fell back to earth with a thud. There was that failed automated donut machine, a competing family company bought by a Japanese business run by Buddhists who asked potential franchisees to ask strangers if they could clean their bathrooms to demonstrate their devotion to service. Bob Rosenberg learned a lot from them. His dad, William, started several small businesses in Quincy, Massachusetts in the 50s, won a series of diners that showcased coffee and donuts. Bob told his dad, hey, how about we just focus on that, and took the company into a billion-dollar business. Bob's new memoir is Around the Corner to Around the World, A Dozen Lessons I Learned Running Dunkin' Donuts. Bob Rosenberg, your dad, hard worker, he enabled you to go to grad school. But how shocked were you when you were 25 and he told you, take it over?
A breathtaking request. You know, I had grown up in the business, so figuratively over the store. I'd done all kinds of jobs. And I fully expected, after I got through with college, I went to hotel restaurant school and then went into the Army and then came back and went to business school. I expected to go into the family business, but had no idea that I'd be requested within a week of graduation to be asked to helm this business called Universal Food Systems.
It was also in the midst of this Shakespearean aspect of the story. I only want to touch on it for a second, but it's sort of a theme throughout the next several decades that your father and your uncle had this huge fight, and your uncle went off and founded the Mr. Donuts chain. And so haunting you all the time was this idea that there was another company that was your competitor, but also was your family.
Absolutely. It was the energy that drove every family conversation. My dad, he felt he started this new way of going to market to thrill customers with the best cup of coffee in the world and with donuts that complemented it. And my uncle, who was not burdened by all the little businesses my dad had spun off into, had started this competitive chain. And by the time I got there in 1963, we had just about opened our 100th store. And Mr. Donut had about 80. And the outcome was very much in doubt as to who was going to emerge and dominate.
You knew that one of the things that Dunkin' Donut had to have was this quality taste. And I'm not just being a shill here for Dunkin' Donuts, although I've been known to eat one or two. But quality control was your selling point.
It was. And because it was going to be focused for the first time, someone was going to focus solely on coffee and donuts, the product had to be the best in the world. I mean, we were fastidious. There's a 27-page standard of regulations about how we go to market in terms of grinding the product and fresh before the customer. You're serving only 18% light cream, which most dairies don't even refine. And same thing applied to the donuts that we sold.
Did you worry? I mean, I'm reading here about how each loaf of dough for one of the donuts has to be rolled out flat, then shrunk to relax the dough. Everything has to be done perfectly. As you're expanding, how much are you worried about that happening?
A lot. But I had, as a kid, my dad decided to go into the hamburger business. I went to work for McDonald's in their first store in Massachusetts. I'm not afraid to borrow a good idea. So we instituted something called Dunkin' Donut University, which I borrowed from McDonald's. They had a hamburger university. So every new franchisee that came into the system had to go through a six-week program, 4 weeks of production and learning how to handle all the technical aspects, but also 2 weeks of management training. And it's an ongoing process. It never ends.
Including, you expect franchisees to educate you. You got a call one day early on about donut holes?
In the early 70s, with the oil embargo, odd and even days of filling your car with gasoline. And I got a call from a fellow by the name of Bob Demery, who is the franchise owner for a couple of stores on Hartford, Connecticut. And he says, you've got to come down and see what my wife Edna's done. For years, we would pick up the middle pieces of the donut holes as we cut the first cuts, we call them. And we would put cinnamon or powdered sugar or plain and put them in these little cellophane bags. And he said, Edna developed a brand new cutter, and she's making them one-fifth the size, the donut holes one-fifth the size. We're frosting them. She's filling them with fillings. And our business is up 20%. It's mind-blowing. You got to come down and see it. And we thought we had a winning idea, and we turned to a small agency. And they said, well, why don't we call them penny poppers? But it was in the middle of wage and price controls and inflation. We never thought we could hold the price anywhere near a penny. And then they suggested, why don't we call them after the people that are named the little people in The Wizard of Oz, Munchkins.
Well, that's one of the fun stories, but they are punctuated by moments of sheer terror when you have to tack or go up to the bathroom, as you write in another moment, and spit up. And that brings us to these franchisees alleging violations of the Sherman Antitrust Act. You were sued.
It was a turning point for me personally. The first 5 years, the strategy that we put in place, streamlining the business, worked extraordinarily well. And then quite truthfully, I lost my way. And that led to big troubles in some of the franchisees. As we took our eye off the ball, we're disaffected. My initial reaction was to sort of get angry at them. It was really sitting in my living room reading a book by David Halberstam, The Best and the Brightest. Halberstam was writing about the Kennedy and Johnson's administration of the Vietnamese War, and that our government was manned at the top by Ivy Leaguers, some of the best and the brightest. They didn't go into the hamlets, into the townships where the war was being waged, listening to the wisdom of the frontline people who had to fight it. And the Viet Cong, our opponents, were, and winning the hearts and minds of the townspeople. And the problem lay with hubris, arrogance. And as I sat in my chair in 1973, I guess it was, I said, oh my God, Halberstam could be speaking about me. And we caucused as a management team. We talked about the book. We decided that our responsibility as leadership was never to blame our followership, but to take responsibility. 100-0. We decided we'd go out and visit each of us 100 stores a year, talk to the franchise owners, ride with our district managers, listen rather than talk, create an advisory council, invite people in to help us solve our problems, apologize for the mistaken strategy that we had. The franchisees themselves came to the defense of the company, saved the company, and opted out of the lawsuit. And for the licensee, for the franchisee, it's an opportunity to go into business for yourself, but not by yourself. You have the advantage of minimizing the risk of a business startup. My goodness, I've heard statistics say that as many as 80% of all new businesses fail within 5 years. Well, the rate of franchisee failure is dramatically less than that.
But Bob, what do you say to people for whom franchise is a word that it's the, you know, the blight upon the country of look-alike stores? It puts local mom-and-pop donut shops, in this case, out of business.
It's not the franchise that decides that. It's the customer. And if it's a better opportunity, they will go there. If it's not, they won't. So there are independents who can deliver convenience and value day in and day out just as well as a chain. They will thrive.
As you said, a couple points, you didn't make the right decisions. In 1974, your board is considering asking you to step aside. You know, you beg for one more quarter, they give it to you. But you'd done things like that donut machine, the automated donut machine, that didn't work. frozen pies, no, nobody wants frozen pies. And then there comes a point where we heard from the wonderful Michael Vail, the actor who played Fred the Baker. Coffee has far passed donuts in what people want. Fred the Baker had to be retired. And then you had a pivot to ads reminding people that it was coffee they were coming for. Let's listen to that.
At Dunkin' Donuts, you can do it. Dunkin' Donuts Coffee. America runs on Dunkin'.
So all's going great. Bob Rosenberg, you're just sky high again, but you end up the focus of a hostile takeover. This is in 1989, as you write, you know, this is the greed is good, go-go days. A guy from Canada buys up your stock. Someone tips you off.
It was scary. That was a hair-raising time. Green mailing. People would buy stock in a company and threaten to put it in play, which meant to find other people to help them buy it and put you out and hold you up for money. A green mailer had attacked the company. We basically had to respond in a seven-month battle. We find a white knight, Allied Lions, and as it turned out, within, oh my goodness, I think a year from the time that they bought us, the hostile takeover fellow, his business went bankrupt. He had lost $100 million. And had he bought Dunkin', the franchisees and all the corporate employees would have been, history.
At its height, how many franchises did you have?
Now, there's something on the order of 12,000.
How much is Dunkin' Donuts worth?
Probably close to $6 billion.
Do you reflect on your dad, who was so exhausted, do you reflect, you must, on, look what happened?
Yeah. And it's an incredibly warm, wonderful feeling, and with tremendous gratitude for all the people that helped that build this wonderful business.
Bob Rosenberg, former CEO of Dunkin' Donuts. His new book is Around the Corner to Around the World, A Dozen Lessons I Learned Running Dunkin' Donuts. Bob, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology, with over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience. Join a virtual info session on Wednesday, October 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. stm.mit.edu.
China's economy is staging a comeback. The world's largest economy grew by 4.9% in its third quarter compared to last year, keeping China on pace to be the only country to post economic growth this year in the middle of the pandemic. So what's going on? Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And as we know, China's economy was in a shambles earlier this year, you know, after the pandemic originated in the port city of Wuhan and forced a national lockdown. Now, daily new cases of the coronavirus are in the single digits. What's behind the relatively quick recovery from that?
Well, I mean, also, we should go back even a year that last year, 2019, the Chinese economy expanded by 6.1% from a year earlier. But that was the lowest growth rate that they had had since 1990. Then you're right. First quarter collapsed, a 6.8% contraction, the first official contraction since the end of the Cultural Revolution in the 70s. Second quarter, 3.2%. Third quarter, 4.9%, as you said. And here's really what I think is going on. The Chinese, although the virus started there, they were fairly quick once they recognized what was going on to shut down their economy. And it was almost a total shutdown throughout the entire country, late January, right through the end of March. The next part of their resurgence was they were very focused on getting their factories up and running. That allowed China to increase their share of global exports. And then finally, a focus on consumers. They encouraged spending and they provided companies with tax rebates and loans from the state-owned banking system. That was so that businesses wouldn't need to lay off workers. I should note that this really did occur without providing any direct relief to Chinese consumers.
Okay, well, we want to talk about how, you know, they and workers, low earners, are faring. But, you know, we remember the lockdown. I mean, we talked to a comedian locked down in China, and he said, you know, he was really busy gaining weight. You know, I mean, they really did it. You know, they just completely, we remember the YouTube videos. Mm-hmm. And that seems to have, you know, helped to stem the coronavirus. But this recovery, I mean, the economic recovery, when, for instance, it puts them at an advantage when it comes to trade.
Absolutely. And, you know, that was interesting. That second step that they focused on, sort of getting those factories up and running, you know, that helped Chinese industrial production surge. In fact, in the quarterly report that we just got, we saw that Chinese industrial production grew by 6.9% from a year ago. And that's pretty amazing. That means that the Chinese industrial side is growing at a faster rate than for much of the previous year. And that means also that that kind of helped them take their industrial production to the highest level. And frankly, they're back and maybe even better than they were before the coronavirus outbreak.
But we know that many of the country's lowest earners, you know, who might have been laid off, turned to migrant work in rural villages. So, you know, how are they doing? Are they coming back to those manufacturing jobs?
I mean, yes, but that I think is a real issue because, you know, funny, back in 2008, the Chinese government did actually hand some cash directly to consumers. And certainly that's been our approach, the approach of a lot of developed economies. But that really hasn't happened. And I do think that the Chinese have the same problem that we have, which is the divide between the wealthiest and the poorest is growing very dramatically.
We heard elsewhere in the show, give some low earners some money too. CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger, thank you.
Great to be with you.
Early voting today begins in Alaska, Arkansas, Colorado, Idaho, and North Dakota. Same goes for many counties across Florida, a state that will undoubtedly play a key role in the presidential election. WLRN reporter Katie Switalski-Munoz joins us now from Fort Lauderdale. And Katie, help us dip a toe for a moment here in the water in Florida, where more than 2.5 million people have already voted by mail. How's the first day of in-person voting going? What are you seeing?
Hi, Peter. So far, it's been a really gray and rainy morning, and that has not stopped voters at all. I visited a couple polls this morning just to see if there were lines. There were long lines in Miami-Dade County. In Fort Lauderdale, there were also lines. And it's really interesting because these are polls that I haven't seen them this busy even on past election days that I've covered. So there's a lot of enthusiasm, and it doesn't feel like the weather has dampened that.
Well, you say it's raining. I looked at some videos. It's pouring in some places. So it's good to see that people are motivated to get out to the polls. And as you know, margins in Florida are usually razor thin on election day. Polls suggest more of the same this year. What can you tell us about how people there on the ground are feeling about Joe Biden and Donald Trump?
Well, South Florida is really urban, and we are Democratic. So right now, so far, of the voters in the whole state that have voted, it's been more Democrats voting by mail than Republicans. That's expected to change in the next coming weeks as more Republicans are expected to vote in person, whether that's early voting or on Election Day. But as far as sentiment goes, there's a lot of Donald Trump signs, particularly in his home county of Palm Beach County, just north of me. And people are really enthusiastic. I mean, his supporters are putting out signs. But as a whole, South Florida is much more Democratic, and we've had more Democrats vote.
Do people feel safe in the pandemic voting?
I think so. From what I've heard, that voters are really confident. I know when you're going to the polls here, you're being encouraged to wear masks. That's going to be interesting as we move forward in terms of enforcing masks at the polls. Here, polls will give you a mask if you don't have one. They also provide hand sanitizer for every voter and clean pens. So all these little things add up to more safety measures at the polls.
WLRN's Katie Switalski-Munoz in Fort Lauderdale. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And one big reason for that surge in early voting, of course, is the pandemic. So let's check in now on the state of the coronavirus, which has infected more than 40 million people worldwide. Tara Smith is a professor of epidemiology at Kent State University in Ohio. Professor, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And last week, Governor Mike DeWine said that this is the worst shape Ohio has been in since the start of the pandemic. Is that a good way to characterize it? What are you seeing?
It's not good, but that is where we are. We saw a record high number of cases on October 17th with over 2,200 cases identified in a single day. We're up to 182,000 total with over 5,000 deaths. So not the place that we wanted to be when we were thinking about opening back up in the spring.
On the other hand, you may have had record single day numbers last week, but I also see that Ohio reported no deaths yesterday. So what explains that? Is there like a lag between the new cases and deaths, or are doctors just getting better at treating it?
A little bit of both. There is a lag, of course, because people become infected and then it takes a while for them to get really sick and unfortunately to pass away. Weekends also are a little tricky. Sometimes numbers are not always reported as quickly on the weekend, so I always take that with a little bit of a grain of salt. But we have seen definitely a decrease in mortality rates over the course of the pandemic, and part of that is probably coming because we are better at treating it now than we were in March and April. And part of that is also because we're seeing more cases in young individuals who are less likely to die from infection.
Well, one of the things that we've noticed as cases surge in the Midwest and also as they surge across the country this fall is that it's happening in many smaller cities and in rural areas, places like New Mexico, Missouri, South Dakota. We just saw that one of Utah's largest hospitals, ran out of beds in its ICU just on Friday. What do you think accounts for the latest surge that we've seen in so much of the country, especially in these smaller places?
Yeah, it's been something that I've been really, unfortunately, waiting for since the spring is for some of these smaller cities and rural areas really to get hit. You know, they were kind of isolated early on because they don't have a lot of contact necessarily with some of the larger cities, which were really kind of the focus early on. But eventually it's going to trickle down to some of these areas, and that's what we're seeing now. So in Ohio, that's where some of our worst outbreaks are in smaller counties in the northwest and southeastern parts of the state. And it doesn't take very much, unfortunately, to overwhelm some of these hospitals because they're small, they're often understaffed, underfunded. And so when it hits hard in some of these areas, as you just mentioned in Utah, it can be really quick for those hospitals to become overwhelmed.
What's the outlook ahead for those places?
Not good right now. You know, what I'm still seeing, even as we see this outbreak increase in Ohio, is a lot of skepticism, especially on the part of people living in small towns and rural areas that tend to kind of lean more conservative and more Republican. And I think those are the ones that have really been affected by some of the misinformation and disinformation, really, that has gone out, unfortunately, from some leaders in the Republican Party. So they're really populations that are susceptible because they're not taking a lot of precautions.
Well, we even saw the president campaigning in Wisconsin over the weekend. It's one of the hardest hit places in the country right now. So I think that gets to what you're saying there. But how much of it has to do with just straight up COVID fatigue? Dr. David Margolis at Metro Health in Cleveland told the Columbus Dispatch recently that people might be approaching their pandemic measures the same way they approach dieting. You know, that is like it's kind of a drag, and it's maybe not a big deal to break the rules every once in a while. Like how much of it is that? We're just sort of tired of living this way.
Yeah, I think that's definitely contributing to it as well. We've seen in Ohio some of the big drivers of these new cases are small gatherings or other types of gatherings. So, you know, weddings, small family gatherings with maybe only 10 or 20 people, but that are inside and unmasked. So these are people that you feel safe with. They're your family members. Maybe they don't look sick, but you don't know who may be incubating that virus and unfortunately spreading it at some of these gatherings. So I think people are starting to let their guard down. They're starting to get tired of, you know, the measures that are in place, understandably so. But the virus doesn't care how tired you are of those measures. And so we're really concerned going forward as it's getting cold. People aren't able to do those activities outside anymore. So they're going to be moving them inside. And that's really when we're expecting cases to rise even further.
Yeah. How concerned are you about some of these small family gatherings that may actually be happening outside? Do you see any evidence that the virus is still spreading that way?
Yeah, there have been a couple reports that, I mean, outside is not a panacea. It makes things less risky, but especially if you spend a lot of time together, if you're in relatively close contact, and if you're unmasked, it can still spread. And I think maybe that message has not gotten out there enough. People think outside is safe. and it's safer, but you still need to take other precautions as well.
But as you say, it's getting colder in much of the country right now. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about efforts to develop a vaccine. Last week, we saw two high-profile late-stage clinical trials paused because of potential safety concerns. That was a potential vaccine from Johnson & Johnson and then an antibody treatment from Eli Lilly. There was another vaccine candidate, AstraZeneca, that took a similar pause about a month earlier. Just taking a look at these, what are your thoughts on the state of these trials across the country?
Yeah, we're paying attention to those. And Pfizer noted this week that they were planning on submitting an emergency use authorization by about mid-November, which is when they'll be wrapping up their phase three trials. So we still have some going forward.
After the election, notably.
After the election, mid to late November. So we still do have some going forward, some that have had some events that have caused concern. And that's the biggest thing that we're worried about here, really, is of course, we want a vaccine that is effective, but most importantly, we want a vaccine that is safe and that is not going to cause harm to those that would get it. So that's why those companies are really taking these extra steps to pause their studies, to look at what's going on with some of those reported events, rather than to just continue carrying them on and potentially having other people harmed from this. So I'm still encouraged that we could have a vaccine start to roll out perhaps in the early part of 2021, but definitely we're not going to see anything before the election and probably for the general public, you know, not in 2020 at all.
Yeah, that's Tara Smith, professor of epidemiology at Kent State University. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Everett, Washington is a longtime manufacturing town, best known as home to the Boeing Aircraft Factory, a place where you could graduate from high school and get a good job without going to college. Well, now that promise of a secure future may be shifting. YR Media's Surya Hendry grew up in Everett and has been thinking about what the future looks like for her and her peers, and she has this report.
It was late August 2016. I was waiting for my junior year of high school to start. And then Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump came to my city, Everett.
In this new future, millions of workers on the sidelines will be returned to the workforce. They've been taken out of the... They are going to return, and they're going to return quickly.
I get why a politician would want to tell our story. Everett's a company town, a poster child for manufacturing, where you could graduate high school, get a job at Boeing, and buy a house. But now that middle-class life thing that people point to feels like it's slipping away. For me and my peers, the story of Everett is also our story, and our fortunes are tied to the city's. Recently, I went downtown to meet up with my friend Kelsey Fassett.
Hey! Hello!
We went to elementary and middle school together. The neighborhood where Kelsey grew up is full of families with parents who worked for Boeing. The neat two-story houses probably look to an outsider like the typical American dream.
That was the blueprint for a lot of people our parents' age.
People are proud of this heritage of blue-collar success that Trump jumped on. But Kelsey is quick to point out that she's on a different path. She goes to a state college and is a computer science major. She's excited to work a tech job in the future.
I am not like most people. The idea of sitting and crunching numbers all day sounds like a dream to me. That sounds awesome. I just love sitting and doing calculations and busy work. I love it.
We talked about how even 10 years ago, that decision to work in computer science would have been really rare. But now many kids in the area are leaving to take on Seattle jobs. Manufacturing doesn't pay the bills the way it used to, and it's not as stable anymore. I've lived here all my life. When my parents were searching for a place to raise a family, they chose Everett, partially because it was affordable and safe for kids.
We were looking for a home that would have a backyard and would be spacious, and plus in a good school district.
That's my mom, Shobna Hendry.
We know many families that have stayed here for generations, but that wasn't something that we were expecting that you and your sister would be here.
Now, my mom wants me to explore the world. As a first-generation American, she had big dreams for our family. Other parents want their kids to follow in their footsteps. Work for Boeing, stay in Everett, build a family here.
I am what's called an assembler installer, so I work on the 767 planes.
That's Charlie Ost. He graduated high school in 2017 and has worked at Boeing for almost 2 years. His stepfather did maintenance as a subcontractor for Boeing.
I don't feel like I belong in this industry necessarily. it's mostly an opportunity thing because, you know, the job pays well, and Boeing obviously is a very large corporation, is going to offer a healthy benefits package, right? It's a good decision objectively for a lot of people in the area.
Charlie says people who were hired right after him are getting laid off, and he worries about getting laid off too. In the spring, Boeing announced a planned 10% reduction in its workforce. More cuts are expected, and headlines about the 787 Dreamliner production leaving Everett have everyone talking. Recently, I asked my mom a really big question.
What do you think would happen in this area if Boeing left Everett?
I think that Everett would see a larger depression of economy than they're already seeing, partly due to the pandemic.
We're both invested in what happens to Boeing, even though my parents don't work there and I went to college more than 800 miles away. We like our neighborhood, which is filled with young families who might not be able to keep their houses during a recession.
Yeah, because we are, at the end of the day, we're interconnected.
Yeah.
I decided to talk to my local representative, Democrat Jared Mead, about the future of Everett as a company town. He's young, 29 years old, and he represents the experiences of my generation.
I lived with my mom till I was in my early 20s and until I graduated college. Most people have not had to deal with what our generation is now dealing with the cost of living, the four-year degree price, the student loan debt interest, all of that.
Mead said now most people here in their early 20s can't buy a house. He couldn't afford to buy a house in the area where he grew up. His father-in-law was a Boeing lifer who got a taste of the classic middle-class lifestyle.
He's now in his early 50s. So he's been there 35, 36 years or something like that. And he lives in the house that he bought with his first 2 years of Boeing paychecks.
To me, this sounds almost imaginary. Many of my friends are leaving because they can make more money elsewhere. Or they feel like Charlie Oss does, that manufacturing might not offer the kind of career they want long term. Young people like me have big decisions to make about whether to stay in our town or leave. And COVID and the economic recession aren't making things any clearer. I just hope that my peers have the choice to stay here in Everett and build a successful future. For Here and Now, I'm Saria Hendry.
And Saria's story is part of a collaboration between YR Media and WNYC's Radio Rookies called 18 to 29 Now Young America Speaks Up. Very cool. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.